Welcome to Troon Talk, where we dig deeply into biodynamic and regenerative organic winemaking and farming. We've been talking a lot about biodynamics lately, so today we thought we'd talk about something a little more concrete, a joke that Nate Wall would like. So our guest today, of course, is Troon winemaker Nate Wall. Hi, Nate. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
And our special guest is Philip Taratko of Artisan Barrels, who is the Nomblo representative of the concrete tanks that we purchased. So welcome, Philip, and could you tell us a little about your background?
Yeah, thank you, Craig. Artisan Barrels and Tanks is supplier of high-end winemaking vessels for all of North America. We represent several different brands, but one of our kind of core suppliers is Nomblo Tanks. It is a producer of concrete tanks out of Torcy, which is kind of southern Burgundy, France. They've been making concrete vessels for over 100 years, originally for all sorts of applications, but for about the last 60, 70 years have really focused on the application of vessels for winemaking. And since the Second World War, have basically made their entire business model focused on winemaking concrete vessels.
And how did you get into this line of work?
Yeah, so previously I was making wine, and so I've worked as assistant winemaker, vineyard manager for in the Willamette Valley, as well as in Marlborough, New Zealand. I worked for most recently, prior to Artisan Barrels, making wine with Andrew Beckham up in the Willamette Valley, who also makes the Novum Amphora, the terracotta vessels that you use at Troon. A very natural winemaking vessel, and you know, applicable to many different winemaking styles, in some ways in the same realm as concrete. You know, you have very good thermal mass in these vessels, promoting more fruit development during fermentation, but you know, in the same world as what I'm doing now. And then in 2021, I had an opportunity to move over from production of wine into sales. And now I currently am the representative for Artisan and Barrels and Tanks for Northern California, kind of from Santa Cruz and up, Oregon, Washington, Canada. And then I do also represent some places on the East Coast as well.
Well, there's just a few wineries in that area.
Yeah, I have a very large client list.
That is. Yes. Yeah. So, Nate, what originally led you to want to use concrete as a winemaking vessel?
Well, I mean, Philip started mentioning some of these when he was talking about the Novum Amphora. And like he said, those are two, in my mind, they're very adjacent kind of winemaking technologies, for lack of a better term there. And he also said it too, which what draws me to it is the purity of fruit. And I think that is what can be expressed by both the terracotta and specifically the concrete. Nomblo in particular, and I would actually like Philip to jump in here, but one of the reasons that we chose Nomblo for the concrete is that it's actually just pure concrete. You know, there's no additives or fillers or any like proprietary compounds that have been added into it. So it's we know what's there, and it's basically just very natural, like, you know, rock and water and stone, and you know, which also then allows for some of that porosity. You know, there are other concrete vessels out on the market, and they're like very shiny and clean looking and everything, but you know, that cuts down on the porosity of the vessel, which is one of the benefits of working with the concrete. So, you know, you have porosity that does allow some of the gas exchange, be it, you know, oxygen or, well, degassing with the carbon dioxide slowly after ferment, and then, you know, just this kind of micro oxygenation during aging. Very slow though. I definitely find the permeability much less than is in, say, an oak barrel, but it's there. So you do get some of the similar characteristics of aging with some small amount of oxygen. And You get, like I said at the outset, that purity of fruit. You know, there is no exogenous flavors being added. Like the concrete doesn't add a taste. It does seem to support or help elevate other flavors that might be in that wine, but it's not actually adding flavors like, say, a toasted oak barrel does.
Absolutely. Do you mind if I jump in and kind of tag on to what Nate was explaining? I think your comment about the terracotta and the concrete being adjacent vessels, I absolutely agree with that. You're in this kind of neutral world, as you said, with an oak barrel, you're toasting wood, you are adding flavors that are being imparted. We kind of dummy things down and use like the tea example of steeping a bag of tea in a cup of water. The oak barrel, the very first use is like that initial steep, the first one, where you're getting lots of flavor extracted into water. As you use the barrel more and more, it's like using the tea bag over and over, where you're getting less and less influence, but inherently you are still getting influence from the oak. And so I think what a lot of people's draw to terracotta and to concrete is there's not that exchange from the material into the wine. Something that is a very unique characteristic of concrete, as is terracotta, is that both of them, the materials themselves, are alkaline. So they're very good at attracting tartrates to stick to the walls, tartrates from the wine to stick to the walls of the vessel. And ultimately, we use the analogy of calling it like a sort of cast iron seasoning, where essentially over time, from your own wines, you're building a seasoning on the inside of the vessel. So in a way, it's kind of the inverse of the oak scenario, where the barrel is imparting flavors into the wine. In this scenario, with the concrete and the terracotta, the wine is seasoning and imparting flavor into the concrete itself. So you have the very high pH concrete and high pH terracotta. You have the wine that has a much lower pH. Those tartrates will stick. You'll create a neutralizing barrier, so you'll no longer be affecting the pH of the finished wine, but ultimately you're creating your own very distinct profile of the vessel itself. As Nate mentioned, Nomblo is one of the only concrete producers out there. They haven't changed their recipe in 100 years. So there's no polymers in the concrete. There's no added chemicals. It is a very natural cement. So people who are really conscious about minimal intervention winemaking and being very conscious about what's put out there in the vineyard and trying to be very holistic from the farming of the grapes all the way through to the production of the wine. I think these vessels fit in really nicely with that sort of profile. Keeping things very natural, keeping things very minimal. Even when it comes down to the cleaning of these tanks, you're not using aggressive chemicals like you would be on stainless steel. The point is really to produce great wines, allow the wines to season the vessel, and then be very minimal with your chemical input, that anything that touches the walls of the vessel itself.
Philip, what is the
Yeah,
history of Nomblo? A little bit, just a little bit on the history of the company.
So as I mentioned, they've been making concrete. At one point, it was kind of like aqueducts and concrete for different kind of plumbing. They were also making the famous story that is told at Nomblo is at one point they were making how do you say it?
Mausoleums.
Mausoleums. Thank you for cadavers. And there's a famous story of a winemaker around about the Second World War who saw these big concrete boxes for bodies, essentially, and put two and two together and realized that that could be a really attractive vessel to ferment and age wine in. So they shifted their production, kind of moved things over towards wine, and realized that there was really a market for that. And to this day, there's wineries in Burgundy that they have vessels that are 50, 60 years old. And as we were saying with that seasoning effect, you can go in there with a little hammer and chisel, and just like a painted wall, you can chip off the tartrates and see years and years of every layer of tartrate that's built over time. That's obviously a pretty extreme example. I think in the new world here, oftentimes we're a little bit more bacterial conscious with how we treat our winemaking vessels. So, we will be maybe a little bit more proactive with cleaning. But just to say that there's people that have been using these for a very long time, have built up a very unique seasoning, and they don't want to change the vessel because the vessel becomes such a important piece of the winemaking. There's so much, living bacteria and yeast and profile that's been created in the vessel that's so unique to that particular winemaking site that, it becomes part of the winemaking program.
And I was going to say earlier, when we started talking about cleaning, that same analogy of the cast iron skillet comes to mind because, if anyone who cooks with cast iron knows, you don't use soap and detergents and scrub the heck out of those. You just, with cast iron, you just kind of rinse them off and they're good to go. And it's the process, right, that cleans them in a way. It's like cooking with them is what cleans them in the same way as like the concrete and the terracotta is that, it's the you kind of clean them and with the mindset of a cast iron skillet and whereas the con whereas like stainless steel is like the Teflon pan, like everything just totally wipes off. It's like nonstick, like and it's there's different purposes for these different materials. But people do ask, and I guess we may as well answer the question all the time. It's like, how should you clean a concrete vessel? Like what's the best method of doing so? I think it's a hang up of a lot of people of getting into concrete vessels is like a nervousness about cleaning.
Yeah, so two pieces. First, I just want to add one little piece about that cast iron cleaning scenario. If you know people who have very treasured cast iron skillets, they're very particular about what you can cook on them, right? You can't just cook anything. You can't just throw bacon on the fish, or you don't want to burn it. People become very proprietary about it because when you take on this mindset of everything you cook adds to the vessel itself. You need to be very particular about how you're seasoning the vessel. So that applies to the concrete tanks as well. You want to make sure your wine is clean and make sure you're taking care of your grapes so you're having healthy fermentations. So it goes kind of both ways of if you're going to remove the output of resetting things back to sterile every time, you need to, be wary of the input and make sure that you're putting quality pieces into it, which, obviously at Schrun Vineyard, you guys are doing lots and lots of work in the vineyard and in the farming aspect to make sure that, you're producing the highest quality fruit and you're very happy with them as they're going in. In regards to Nate's second question here, about cleaning. That's an interesting piece, and it's not a exact formula. I would say it's more of a range and kind of depending on each winemaker's individual philosophy about winemaking, you can kind of find yourself somewhere within the range. We have folks in the United States that have had these tanks for over 25 years and have never done anything but a tartaric acid solution rinse. So the very first time you get these tanks, the concrete itself is very alkaline. You need to apply tartaric acid at about a 30% dilution rate in order to neutralize the pH of the concretes. If you didn't do that, you would be pulling the pH out of the wine. And obviously, you work very hard to pick grapes at the right the acidity at the right Brix. You don't want to take that away with the vessel you're using. So you treat the grapes with the 30 per or you, excuse me, you treat the concrete tanks with the 30% solution. You've neutralized the pH. From there, it's safe to put grapes in there. So if you find yourself in on the spectrum of people that are very happy with the cleanliness of your wine from like a bacterial standpoint, you can just over time be very minimal with how much of the tartrates you're cleaning off, and then start to lower the tartaric solution that you're using to treat the tank. So you can bring it down to 25% the second year, 20%, and then over time, as you have a nice tartrate seasoning already built up, be about at the 10-15% dilution rate. Another thing, as we were mentioning before, in the New World, I think people can be a little bit more bacterial conscious. A very common way to clean these is with like a very diluted peroxycarb solution or caustic. You're in the same realm here. To me, the best way to do it is with some good elbow grease and a bucket and a scrub brush, and you make up You're very diluted chemical, much more diluted than you would use in like a stainless vessel. And essentially, you dip the soft brush in there, and you just scrub the walls of the tank, getting the thickest, you know, grape skins, the thickest particles off. And then from there, you would give a nice water rinse. And then because you treated the tank with a higher pH cleaning solution, you need to at that point retreat with a tartaric solution in order to re-neutralize the pH. The key to me about getting these clean is really about getting them nice and dry. What you don't want to do in a concrete tank is allow humidity to build up over time. You can think of like the basement analogy. You know, if you've ever been in someone's basement that has very poor ventilation, it smells like a musty basement. You know, and you can imagine four concrete walls, concrete roof, concrete base, humidity stuck in there, you're going to start to get a basement smell. So a key is getting them nice and dry after you've completed your kind of cleaning regimen. So it can be something as simple as just putting a box fan in there for 24, 48 hours, just getting the humidity out. And then during the time where they're sitting empty, leaving the valves open, leaving the lid with just a little bit of ventilation, just in order to not build up humidity inside of the tank itself. One really positive note about concrete that I think should reassure many winemakers out there is the risk of bacterial contamination from one year to the next in concrete is significantly lower than the risk in wood. So, you know, if you're talking about big oak tanks, you need to be more aggressive with the cleaning. You need to use holding solutions like tartaric sulfur or citric sulfur or sulfur gas. Those things you don't need to do in concrete. You just need to make sure it gets nice and dry and you're happy with the level of tartrate cleaning that you've achieved. For wineries that use ozone, like liquid, you know, ozone and liquidated ozone, you can put ozone on concrete as well. So for people that are very, very bacterial sensitive, that's a very useful tool just prior to filling before the next fermentation. You know, you give it a nice water rinse so it's all wet. Give it a quick ozone rinse. It will kill everything on the surface of the vessel. A water rinse, and then you're good to refill it. So again, you know, you fall somewhere on this spectrum of how comfortable you are with wine buildup over time. You know, for example, you guys at Troon are using a lot of native yeasts. You're not inoculating things. So if you're bringing things back to a 1,000,000% sterile every time, you're actually killing those healthy, good yeast populations that you like in the winery. So I think, rather than having the perspective of like a hard line, black and white, clean and dirty, we need to, in ways, think about like a vineyard perspective of having healthy populations and having things in balance with each other. So, you know, you have your good yeast that are living happily, and you have your good bacteria that are living happily, and you know, putting grapes in there that themselves are healthy and have the necessary foods for those bacteria to ferment and create good wines.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I was on this other panel for the Oregon Wine Symposium, and they were discussing if you're using more it was specifically about non-Saccharomyces yeast, but just kind of in general, if you're allowing for a greater microbial diversity, does that in the winery, does that make you know, does that change like your cleaning regimens? And you know, a lot of people were saying, oh yeah, you know, you have to be even cleaner. But like I was the dissenting voice. I was like, well, yes, but in some ways, you it's very possible to become too clean, especially with you know, we trust our native microbiome here, right? That is why we, like you kind of mentioned, this why we put so much effort out into the vineyard with the practices we do, organic and specifically biodynamic viticulture, which really helps the populations of just a diverse and healthy microbiome going on out there. So we're very comfortable with what is coming in, like microbially, into the winery. And like, you know, while you need to be sanitary, you don't need to be sterile, right? It's like there's a difference between like clean and sterile. And I actually really like the concrete vessels for the fact that they can be clean, you know. And so like we clean them, and we use a box fan, we dry them out, and then once they're dry, it's actually great that they can just stay that way and they just stay clean and, until we want to use them again. And then the more we use them, and we've only used them now with the, we got the egg first, and then we have these other vessels. But that buildup is going to help accelerate kind of that initial like lag phase, right? And in the winemaking process, is having this population of healthy from the previous ferment, yeast and bacteria present, really just kickstarts that process a little bit, and leads to more healthy ferments. So I think that is an advantage, like you were saying, of the concrete in my world, especially in a minimal kind of intervention perspective. That's a real benefit. Whereas our barrels, once we empty the barrels, they actually take quite a bit of labor too. Once they're empty, we have to continue to like try to steam them, and because the barrels are going to dry out, and those staves will start shrinking. And a lot of people might not know this, but there aren't nails or glue or anything that holds these barrels together, right? It's just they're perfectly shaped, and if they start drying and they start shrinking, they're going to leak. And so you have to kind of consistently maintain empty barrels in particular, until you use them again the following season. And that same process is not really necessary with the concrete. I mean, you need to treat it well, like once, but then it's pretty much good to go until you fill it again, for example. So, yeah, I find that that's a real benefit for us in our cellar.
I think just to bounce off Nate's idea there, I absolutely agree with you about, clean, not sterile, because when you are totally sterile, you're essentially resetting the balance. And if you introduce something from there that's very dominant, like you could think of like a cultured champagne yeast, for example. It's a yeast that is designed in a laboratory to perform in very, very low acidities, to ferment even with very little residual sugar. It's a very powerful yeast. So as you would be to bring one of these yeasts into a winery, it's really going to dominate and outpopulate any other healthy yeasts that are happening. So if every time you're bringing things back to zero and you're eliminating the natural population, you're really susceptible for any particular dominant yeast profile or dominant bacteria profile to just take over from there. You've eliminated the population and created a clean slate for a new one. I think wineries that fall more in the sterile category tend to be wineries that use cultured yeasts, and their perspective is they only want the influence of the yeast that they're making up from their particular selection. But when your focus is on bringing in healthy yeasts from the vineyard, these are natural organic yeasts that are forming in that vineyard environment. They're not cultured in a laboratory. So, when put neck and neck with a very resilient, factory produced yeast, the factory produced yeast is probably going to take over from there. I think winemakers who take the perspective like Nate, a lot of folks are very hesitant to introduce any exterior yeasts into their winery for fear that it will outperform the healthy native population that's already in existence.
So, well, we have three types of concrete vessels now. We have an egg, dolia, and tanks. Maybe we could run through each vessel and talk about its unique characteristics and, Nate, what your intentions are for these tanks.
Yeah, so I think this is probably true, and Nate can elaborate in a moment just on like what varietals are chosen for which vessels. But in general, the dolia, which is the amphora shape, so it's kind of like an egg with the pointed part to the bottom, tends to be used for whites and very light reds. Anytime you have that sort of egg shape, you're creating convection and movement within the wine, so it's turning over on its lees. So in a way, the egg and the dolia perform in a similar way. The main difference here is that the dolia, the cone, is pointed down, and the egg, the cone, is pointed up. So when you're thinking about the amount of lees bed that you're forming in the egg, you're going to have a much larger surface area of lees in contact with the wine because it's sitting in the bulb in the bottom of the egg. So you will likely see more turbidity, which means more solids that stay in suspension in the egg versus the dolia, which will also create convection, but but you have the conical bottom, so it's going to trap a little bit more of the lees on the bottom. So you have a smaller surface area of lees contact, and you'll probably have slightly less turbid wine, so less suspended solids in the wines themselves. In the cubes, which you guys are using for the red ferments, the huge advantage you have here is strictly volume. You can do a larger ferment. The other advantage is those tanks are designed to have a door that lines up right to the slope bottom of the tank, so it makes it much easier to dig out for a red ferment. You could do red ferments in the egg in the Dolia. It would be a much more difficult dig out to get the pumice out of the vessel. Simply because of the way that the doors are aligned and sort of the shape and the access that you have on top of the vessel itself. All of these vessels are going to have very good thermal inertia because concrete has lots of thermal mass. So you'll see very slow increases of temperature, very slow decreases of temperature. All of them are going to have a slight porosity to them. And one thing, Nate spoke about porosity earlier. Just one thing I wanted to add in regards to the porousness of the concrete tanks is they're working a little bit differently than an oak barrel. And the reason is in an oak barrel, you have a hard bung in there, so you're creating a vacuum because over time the wine is concentrating. So you're actually pulling air through the walls, through the staves of the barrel, and that's where you get the influence of the oak, is the air is passing through the walls, through the staves into the wine itself. In a concrete tank, the porosity is occurring with the air bubbles that are essentially trapped into the concrete itself. So you have aggregate concrete, which is essentially just like chunks and rocks and all sorts of this just natural material that makes up the core of the tank itself. And then you have what we call a barbotine layer, which is a very, very finely ground layer, which is on the interior walls and the exterior walls. And it is exactly the same base material. It's just one is finely ground, one is aggregate with chunks and pieces. The aggregate creates a much more stable structure, and the barbotine, the thin set, creates a nice thin wall, a nice flat wall for the interior of the tank. So you're not dealing with bumps and rocks sticking out. But the porosity is going to come from all that air that was trapped in the concrete as it was dried over time. As Nate said, it's a little bit of a different, you don't quite notice the immediate porosity of the vessel quite as much as you'll notice the porosity of an oak barrel. But we've done many tests over time with dissolved oxygen in older tanks, and there's absolutely dissolved oxygen occurring. The vessel is far from inert. It's just not exactly the same dynamics of oxidation as in, say, an oak vessel.
Quick question for you on that, actually. So is that does that get like recharged basically once it gets empty? Or I mean, is that like is there a certain amount of oxygen that vessel is like holding that's kind of bleeding, into the wine over time? And like would that change then if you stored wine for an extended period of time in concrete? Like would it like run out of that or yeah, like and then does it get recharged upon being empty? Obviously, it's exposed to the air again, and those spaces like recal or re equilibrate or something, or like how does that work?
There's just a lot of air just trapped in that aggregate that you're tapping it very, very slowly over time. So we don't see any differences of when you do dissolved oxygen, you're looking at grams per liter per year is mostly the standard way of kind of measuring that. And we've had many people that have over time measured it, at 1 month, at 2 months. At 3 months, at 6 months, at 12 months. And it's not that we see any sort of decline over time. It's a little bit of like the magic of the vessel. It would be very, very difficult to tell you, like, per cubic centimeter, the amount of trapped oxygen within. And then the other important piece to consider is a lot of it is going to depend on how you treat the vessel, right? If you're allowing your tartrates to build up over time, you've maybe created more spaces for oxygen to trap within the tartrates, or you've sealed the porosity by covering all of those pores. So it's a very kind of subjective answer depending on how you're treating the tank over time. But we can say with certainty, there's a pretty comfortable range of these vessels between, let's say, 0.04 to 0.09 grams per liter per year of dissolved oxygen in the vessel. I actually just visited somebody up in kind of northern Washington very recently, and they had they called it a MOG machine. I'm not sure if Nate, you've ever seen these. It's the first time I've seen this, but I guess it's a machine that no longer exists. But it's essentially a an aerator. So it's this little tiny machine that pumps oxygen and uses like a sparging stone into the tank. And they explained to me they're making Syrah, so a rather reductive, Nate knows a lot about this, a rather reductive varietal. And they were using the essentially the sparging stone during fermentation until the end of malolactic fermentation, and then they would stop from that point because what they found is they really liked this sort of injection of oxygen to a very small level. Until the ferment was over, and then at that point they decided, the wine was very sensitive to oxygen, so they liked just the slow, consistent rate that was happening within the concrete itself. That's definitely a winemaker preference, a different vineyard site, different grape preference. So Rhone varietals are interesting because we're here in Oregon, right? And Nate and I have had this conversation before, but everyone just thinks Oregon Pinot Noir, right? And Pinot Noir is one of those very few varietals out there where very rarely is it racked during élevage, right? Most people will press off Pinot Noir, allow it to settle in a tank, allow a somewhat clean settle, put it into its aging vessel, and then most, I would say, a large majority of winemakers out there do not rack until they are ready to make the final blends. If you look at like a Bordeaux varietal, for example, Cabernet Sauvignon, Malbecs, Merlots, Cabernet Francs, most people are racking multiple times during the élevage period to introduce oxygen into these varietals. What's interesting about the Rhone varietals is this is where you have like the meeting point of people that take the Burgundian, don't rack, don't introduce oxygen perspective, and then you have people that have the Bordeaux, rack multiple times, introduce more oxygen throughout the fermentation period or even the élevage period. In any case, you could achieve that through different ways. If you want more oxygen intake, you could use something like a microoxygenator. You could even just do a rack and return during malolactic fermentation. I think here is where we like delve into the plethora of infinite permutations of winemaking perspectives. But I'm curious to hear a little bit about Nate's perspective here, just about, élevage and racking and, how you feel like that fits into the Rhone varietals in particular.
Yeah, so I agree that, and I think that's what makes these Rhone varieties so fun is that they are kind of a bit of a meeting of the minds with Burgundy and with Bordeaux, for example, as you were mentioning, and so I've clearly been my practices have been informed by over 10 years in the Willamette Valley. And so unsurprisingly, I'm on the Burgundian side of that argument. And at Troon, all of our wines are pretty much left on their lees, on their primary lees the entire time, up until bottling. So we only rack for bottling with rare exception. Every once in a while there may be like that one Syrah barrel, because as you mentioned, Syrah, is just one of the most reductive varieties out there. And if I could, I could have a lot of 20 barrels and three vintages, like they're all 20 are great. And then like one vintage is like this one barrel just needs like a little bit of help. So but in general, yeah, we leave the wine in that vessel for the entire time up until we bottle it. And then in terms of the vessel usage, yeah, right now, the cubes are ours are kind of rectangles, but cubes that we are the big advantage of those is that, as you mentioned, they have this large port on top that allow you to load the grapes fairly well, fairly easily into them. It's still a very physical process of getting several tons. We're talking thousands of pounds of grapes into each one of these, but you can use them, those cubes can be used as a red fermentation vessel, much easier than, like you were mentioning, than the Dolium or the egg that we have. So yeah, but so for us right now, we do have predominantly Rhone varieties, and I have a Syrah in one of our cubes. I wanted to this year, but I didn't quite have enough to fill it. I'm really excited to put Grenache in there. And it's, I was back to the oxygen conversation. I was thinking that there may be a little more permeability, or maybe that's the wrong word, but oxygen ingress than there is, or than I have seen with the Syrah. And of course, like I said, the Syrah is the most reductive. So, like, kind of going over to Grenache, which is the literally the opposite of that. It's like the most oxidative variety. I want to see, and I'll have them side by side too. I'll have Syrah in one and Grenache in another, and you can really look at the reductive and oxidative tendencies of those two varieties, and then how the vessel kind of modulates those tendencies that each grape has. Which, I mean, and just from a general winemaking perspective, that is why Syrah and Grenache are so commonly blended, is that they're like opposite polarities, and they do play really well together for that reason. So yeah, we're happy with the vessels for the ability to both ferment the red grapes, red wines in. And then a little unique in terms of fermenters is that it does have a lid that sets on top, clamps down, and then we can then store the wine back in the same vessel. So we have a whole lot of vessels here that are only fermenters, right? Like, we ferment in them during harvest, and then the wine, once it's fermented, it goes into something else, which is, often a oak barrel. We use neutral oak, but and then so those fermenters are empty for the rest of the year until we use them next harvest. What's really great about these vessels is we ferment in them, and then we press off. It's got a door at the bottom, so we can unload them basically back into picking bins that we can then use, dump into the press, press off the wine, and then put the wine back into the same vessel. So that's a real advantage of these vessels from a red wine making perspective, is that you can use them as fermenters and then also as storage for the rest of the year. And in terms of storage, it's actually it's a it seems like a non-romantic thing to talk about, but they're actually a really good use of space as well, because our vessels are everything's in hectoliters with down below, but it's 792 gallons is each one of ours, right? And so that's like 13 barrels ish of wine, in a much smaller footprint than 13 barrels would take up in the cellar. So it's actually useful from a lot of reasons. Now that we're talking about storage, I think I should also bring up the same thing that you mentioned during fermentation, that thermal mass that the concrete has. What's so great about that for fermentation is that you do see these very slow, gradual temperature gains. You never see any like heat spikes. And then you see this really long, just steady temperature, and then a very slow temperature decline. That's really great, like fermentation kinetics, especially for like these kind of spontaneous ferments that are perhaps not as vigorous as, like you were saying, as some of these kind of commercial yeasts can be much more vigorous. So being able to maintain their heat easier throughout that ferment is, I think, really beneficial for our spontaneous ferments that we do here. But then that same tendency is really helpful for aging, because if the vessels are not as sensitive to temperature fluctuations in the cellar, because they're basically heavily insulated. And so if we have them in our winery, and if we have to open up the roll-up door to move things in and out, and the temperature in the winery changes a bit, it takes a long time to affect the temperature of those concrete vessels. Like, 792 gallons of wine in a concrete vessel takes a very long time to like nudge that needle. So it's really nice that stability, temperature stability for aging is also, I think, beneficial for it. Yeah. And then I guess to finish up, so yeah, we have an egg, and then like the dolia or dolium, we have one of them, is like an upside down egg. And we have seen certainly the egg, we have white wine in both of them. We're using them both for white wine. Our egg doesn't even have a door on it, so it would be incredibly difficult to do any red wine in there as a fermentation. Of course, we could always store red wine in there, but we use ours right now. We've been using it for Roussanne for the past 2 years, and we've really liked the results with that. We find that Roussanne does have a well, one has great natural acidity. That's often what Roussanne adds to a grown white blends is. Roussanne's kind of I refer to it as like Roussanne's often the skeleton, like the structure that some of these other like fruitier or other maybe even more heavily aromatic, so like Viognier for heavy aromatics or Marsanne for a little fleshier. It's like but it's Roussanne that sits on, and Roussanne by itself in the egg is really nice because the for us our Roussanne and many of our grapes, which is what I love so much about our growing conditions, is we are able to ripen grapes at lower sugar levels oftentimes because we have these big temperature changes during the day, diurnal temperature changes, and it allows sugars to and flavors to mature during the day, but then the heat drops at nighttime, and so the bricks, the sugars stop rising, and we maintain our acidity. That's just part of our winemaking here. But in with the Roussanne, then in this tank, we have this really low alcohol Roussanne, like in 10.5 or 11%, oftentimes. But that lees contact in the egg, it really adds nice like weight to the Roussanne. So you can have a wine that is light. I mean, it's 10.5, 11%, but it's not thin. And so it's and with the Roussanne especially, that tendency that it has to express some minerality in the variety, I think that is, like I was saying before, the vessel supports that tendency, right? Or maybe another way of saying it is oak barrels, even somewhat used oak barrels, might still have enough remaining flavor to cover up some of this nuance that these varieties have. And like because concrete doesn't do that, you can still like taste and appreciate those things. So that's why we've really liked the egg for the Roussanne so far. And this is the first year we used that Dolium, and we used it for Vermentino, and similar reasons, but we did still see quite a bit of turbidity in the Dolia, so I'll be interested to see if that's like a vintage thing, or if we but I think beneficially, because we did see more turbidity basically means more lees contact. More lees contact means more texture in the finished wine. So we also saw that in the Vermentino that we put in the larger Dolium. So yeah, that so these are different vessels that we have, and they each seem to aid in a different type of winemaking style, and that's kind of what we're doing here. With Etrun is because we do grow 20 different grape varieties, and so trying to figure out what the right vessel to use for some of these different varieties to kind of maximize the expression of that variety. That's what all these different vessels allow, a different tool in our toolkit, basically in winemaking to more fully express these different varieties we have.
I think
Yeah, Nate, the 22 Roussanne, that's our first all concrete wine that we've released, and it is unique to have that low alcohol, but that great mouthfeel, and the texture, I think, is one of the defining aspects of concrete and clay. Philip, can you talk a little bit about the texture aspect of these vessels?
In white wine, you could probably make a good analogy to like batonnage, which is the process of stirring a barrel, which is it's traditionally done in, but just stirring any sort of vessel in order to resuspend the lees and allow those solids to reinteract with the wine, and then eventually will settle out. But in the egg shape or in the dolia shape, you just have this constant convection that's caused by the temperature difference of the cooler wine on the bottom and then lower on the top, and then the volume disparity. So you're basically just getting this constant suspension of solids, which is building up this sort of it's richness without sweetness, I think might be a good way to describe it. And it just gives a unique sort of texture there. Even in the vessels such as the cubes, which are, obviously you're not going to get that same sort of convection movement of the wine as you would in the egg shape, whether it be a dolia, the egg on its head, or the egg upright. Even in the cubes, when you have these fermentations in this, alkaline natural material with very cool and steady, you get this sort of, I always think of it as a sort of like fleshing out of the fruit characteristic. So it's building this sort of mid palate quality. Sometimes I think of it when it shows in its best, it kind of reminds me of like a strawberry smoothie, where you have like the thicker, sweeter fruit quality, but then you also have that like graininess of the seed that gives it this really nice dichotomy of textures. I definitely think there's something very distinctly unique about concrete mouthfeel, whether it be for whites or for reds. And just to make a quick comment here, Nate is mentioning how he's using the egg and the dolia for whites. We definitely have folks that are using these for reds as well. You mentioned Grenache earlier. We have a lot of folks that make Grenache in the eggs, for what you said earlier of wanting to have lower porosity, because very quickly Grenache can like oxidize and show those kind of more tired fruit characteristics. So you want to keep the freshness, but you also want to build body and complexity in the wine, which is where the egg for Grenache can be really interesting. At the end of the day, I think Nate's analogy to, like tools in the tool shed, I always think of it as like, tools in the kitchen, right? Certain winemaking tools are like spices. Like a barrel is like a spice. It's something you're adding to what you're cooking. The concrete tanks, you could think of maybe as more like different cooking vessels, right? Like you might not cook the same thing in a wok as you would cook in a cast iron, as you would cook in a regular skillet, versus you would cook in, a large soup pot, right? Like depending on what your intended outcome is, you're going to use different tools to achieve that. And to me, concrete, oak, stainless, terracotta, porcelain, whatever the vessel may be, some of these things will act as spices, some of these things will act as, cooking vessels. But the goal is really just to tailor your winemaking program so the traits of whatever vessel you're using match your intention of the style of wine you're trying to make. And unfortunately for winemakers out there, there is no perfect formula. I cannot just show up and tell you, you want to make this wine, you need this. There's certainly trends, and there's certainly things that people find really useful. Winemakers with similar perspectives often have similar, opinions about different sort of vessels. But that's the magic of winemaking, right? Is that the permutation of options are endless. And, you can cook a really good stir fry in a cast iron, you can cook a really good stir fry in a soup pot, you can cook a good stir fry in a wok. Each one will be a little bit different. You can use different spices. Each one will be a little bit different. There's no perfect recipe, but in an ideal world, the tools that you're using match up to the ingredients that you're using to create, the best wine that you can possibly make.
So Nate, besides Philip being a great sales rep, why did you pick these tanks?
Well, I think I mentioned with Nunblo, we were looking for that mainly because it synced up with our values here, in terms of the fact that it's a better match having a very natural vessel, and one that's made naturally without chemical inputs, and other additives, was just kind of an extension to everything we do both in the vineyard and the winery here. even though there was so the biggest downfall for me is that these vessels are produced in France and they are shipped in a container across the ocean. And so there is that was definitely consideration. Like we consider everything we do here in terms of the carbon footprint, basically the ecological impact of what we do. All of our packaging and bottles and everything, for example, are very very thought through. The type of material that we make for that we use for the labels, the type of corks or closures that we use. We think about all these things both from a protecting of the wine perspective, as well as protecting of the planet and the ecological benefits, or lack thereof. And so, shipping something from Europe when there are options domestically was something we definitely had to consider. But at least, what we did decide to do then is we maximized our shipping containers. So, Philip gave us these great little basically diagrams of like, what you can fit in a shipping container, right? And so you could figure out, oh, well, if you order these vessels and this, then you've filled that one shipping container. So by at least maximizing, what we purchased and when we did it, that just made the shipping that much more efficient from an emissions perspective. And it's actually shipping via container, via ocean is a pretty darn low carbon footprint method of transportation. So for example, if there was like an East Coast manufacturer of vessels and we had to truck those vessels from the East Coast over to us, that would be a very similar, if not slightly higher carbon footprint, trucking them that far than for us to receive those vessels into the Port of Oakland or something like that, and then driven up the coast to us. So we did consider these things and as well, but we really wanted to make this work for the advantages we've talked about with Nablo specifically. Another advantage to think of though with these concrete vessels is they do not need replacing, right? And this Nablo has been making these vessels for almost 100 years now, and I bet Philip can tell us that there are several places that have almost 100-year-old vessels still in operation. So unlike oak barrels, where we especially at Troon, we I'm all about neutral oak, so we use barrels long past the time that many other wineries would discard them. Because they're using them, largely for, well, not largely, but they're looking for the seasoning aspect. I mean, the spice component, the spice rack component. And as Philip mentioned with his tea analogy, the more times you use a barrel, the more it loses that spice. And basically, the second it loses that spice, like that's when I want it. And so that's when I purchase it from these wineries that are getting rid of it, but they're buying the barrels every single year. And so there's carbon footprint implications for people using barrels as well. And so yes, this was a larger kind of carbon footprint hit that we took with that shipping very heavy vessels. But they like I said, one of these vessels holds 13 barrels worth of wine in the case of the cubes, and that's we're never going to buy like we will not have to replace that vessel. So this will be lasting for decades. And so I think when taking the long view, these vessels could be seen as actually a more sustainable carbon footprint than some other options. Yeah. So anyways, a strange ecological answer probably to your question, rather than the winemaking one that I kind of gave earlier about like why we were interested in these vessels. But it is just something we consider at Troon with all aspects of our growing, our winemaking, and our packaging. We do consider the ecological impacts, and I think that concrete actually plays fairly well into that aspect of our business as well.
Yeah, I think concrete is rock and sand and water. You don't have to cut down a tree to make it as well. So the logistics obviously is an important piece to consider. And then, also the fact that you don't, kill a living tree, for the defense, because we also sell oak barrels and are very involved in the coopering industry, just for the defense of the coopering industry. The reason French oak is so desirable in the world is there is a system in forests, that has been in existence since Napoleon. He was actually the one that put this in place, of managing the forests to which you are cutting down trees at a rate to sustain the growth of the forest, and things are very tightly managed by the ONF, the government agency that manages the forests. In any case, the oak world is conscious of this. You're not just clear cutting things. But yeah, I think from Nate's perspective, logistics is almost an inevitable piece that are going to be hit in when you're talking about, winemaking vessels, and doing something one time in a rather low emissions fashion, knowing that the tanks are going to last a very long time. I think that's a very, ecologically responsible, perspective to have.
Well, Philip, thank you for your time today. We're really excited about these vessels and the wines that are going to produce in the future. And we really like to thank you for the support you gave us through this whole process. We were here for every minute of the rather perilous installation of these tanks. And it's been great working with you. So where can people find out more information, websites, email, and things like that, where they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, thank you for asking. Well, first, very quickly, credit to Nate and his previous assistant winemaker Hannah. They were very, very as involved as I was in the installation. That credit must be given where it is due. And so I would say that was very much a team effort. And then yeah, in regards to interest in concrete tanks or interest in our products, artisanbarrels.com. Anyone is welcome to contact me out there. My email is Philip, PHILLIP at artisanbarrels, all one word, .com. And yeah, I like to talk about wine, as I believe is true of both of you guys. So we'd be happy to engage conversations for people's interest.
Hey, Nate, Philip, thank you.
Thank you very much, Craig.
Cheers.
Absolutely, thanks, and a big shout out to Philip again. All of his help, just not even not just the installation, which was very, very much appreciated, but the entire ordering process and helping us determine the sizing of the vessels and kind of what would be appropriate for our needs was really great. So strongly recommend anyone listening who might have interest. Yeah, go ahead and contact Philip. He was a great person along this journey we're having here.
Thank you, Nate.
We are happy to share this podcast from Troon Vineyard, a Demeter Biodynamic and Regenerative Organic Certified winery in Oregon's Applegate Valley. We farm like the world depends on it by growing produce in our gardens and naturally crafting authentic wines. We will be sharing these in-depth podcasts several times a month. To learn more, I encourage you to visit our website at troonvineyard.com and those of the Regenerative Organic Alliance at regenorganic.org. And Demeter Biodynamics at demeter-usa.org. Thanks for sharing our voyage to regenerative agriculture with us.